On the Wintrust Business Lunch with Philip Shaw, Senior Advisor at Goldstone Financial Group. Hi, Philip. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, John. Happy to be here.
I wonder if we still need to process a little bit the inflation numbers and the decrease that we saw last week. It got some attention, but it was rather historic, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been really nice to see a decrease in the inflation rate. It's a first one in, almost 2 years. But I'm always a little bit hesitant. You know, we had one of these good numbers at the end of last year, and they come back a couple of months later. They revise the number. Turns out it's higher than expected, still trending the way that we want it to, which is really great to see.
Trending in what way? Talk a little bit about that.
Well, the year-over-year inflation is back down about 3%, which is great. Yeah, that's where we're headed towards is the Fed's goal of a 2%. But as Chairman Powell even said today, is if they wait to decrease interest rates until they hit 2%, they'll probably have waited too long. So the trend is what we're looking for.
Right. So then, what does that mean? Right. You don't want to wait till it gets to 2%. You've waited too long. So when do you pull the trigger?
You know, unfortunately, it's not something that they'll know until they've done it. Once they've made that first rate cut, they'll see what happens with the economy, with the market, with jobs and inflation. The expectation is we'll see two of them this year. We'll probably see it in September and December is going to be the outlook, at least for now.
Yeah, which is rosy compared to, a month ago, a few weeks ago. Zero was talked about, one was talked about. And when I asked people, if I set the line at 1.5, where are you? Most were under. I know a few months before that, some folks were speculating it might be 4, 5, or 6. But 2 is a good number if you're looking for a lot of rate cuts this year.
Oh, I agree. And if you look back at the start of the year, just when you and I were talking about it, as we were talking about 3 rate cuts during this year, and I'd still like to see 2 if we can. You know, we are starting to see an uptick in unemployment, especially in, the white-collar professions are seeing a lot more uptick in unemployment, layoffs coming around from companies. And the Fed's really, they're balancing both jobs right now. They need to decrease inflation and get price stability. And on the other end, they need to make sure they don't drive us into a recession.
Seems like one number is always pushing or pulling another number and then another number adjusts. I wonder what if we want to see inflation at 2%, I just wonder what if you had to pick Nirvana for the 3 numbers, inflation, interest rates, and unemployment, realistically, I wonder what they could be. And how close are we to those numbers right now?
You know, it's a great question. Unfortunately, I don't have an answer for you on it of what the perfect number looks like. Full employment's been about 5 or 6% unemployment, and we're below that today. So right. I think they're happy with where the overall economy sits.
Right.
They just want to make sure they don't do something too early and spend us back into an inflation cycle.
Well, you're thinking the way I'm thinking. Okay, so unemployment is about where it can be. Interest or inflation is 3% is pretty dang close to 2. The interest rates are the bugaboo for people, but you don't want to do anything too rapidly so as to upset the others. And, of course, we need to pay attention to the trends. I want you to just go down that path just a little bit more with me. Philip Shaw, Senior Advisor at Goldstone Financials, talking to us a little bit about some of the indices and the relationship between interest rates, inflation, and unemployment. I don't want to dwell on that too much, but I was just making the point a moment ago that we're actually pretty close to the numbers that we want on all 3, aren't we?
Yeah, we really are. I was listening to Fed commentary maybe 5 or 6 years ago when we were talking about a 2% goal for inflation, and the point was to remember that it's an average. So we spent a number of years below 2%, and we've spent a couple of years above, significantly above, but I always like to remind myself that it's an average. We don't need to hit it and stay there. So as long as we're pretty close, which seems to be where we're at, I think the Fed can start making some moves back to lower interest rates.
I wonder if you have to figure out, too, it's the middle of summer. In fact, we are, today's July 15th, so as many days to the left and right of us. in the summer months. We're right smack dab in the middle. How does that affect spending? How does that affect the economy?
You know, during the summer, a lot of people spend more than they would other times of the year. There's a lot of vacations, there's a lot of concert shows, entertainment. And so, you know, right now, the inflation probably feels a little bit more real to people than it might, say, 3-4 months from now when all that slows down.
What about travel and stuff like that, entertainment? What sort of numbers do you see out there on that?
Well, this is where I always say inflation is personal to you, is if you're somebody who travels a lot, if you're flying, if you're taking vacations, your personal inflation rate has probably been a lot higher. We're seeing record numbers in terms of costs for flights, for hotels, for really everything related to vacation. And a lot of that's helping drive our inflation numbers higher.
Yeah, right. I guess it's good for those businesses, though. If you're an airline, a car rental company, if you're Disney, or at least at one of the theme parks, that's all good, right?
Yeah, I mean, hotel costs are up about 16%. We've seen year-over-year car rentals up about 40%. They're certainly doing well, and you know what? People seem to be okay spending the money on it. They might not like it, but they're still doing it.
Yeah, that's almost a double-edged sword, isn't it? I mean, so the economy marches on even as we're putting it on our credit cards. You know, we don't talk that much about that, but the amount of debt Americans are carrying, to say nothing of the federal deficit, those are real numbers.
Oh, they certainly are, and it's one of the biggest things that I counsel around when it comes to spending, is make sure you understand what is your budget look like and what is the long-term cost of putting something on a credit card. You know, if you're making nothing but the minimum payments, you tend not to pay that credit card off for maybe 9 years, and it tends to be about, you know, 7-8 times what you purchased it for just because of the interest. I mean, putting things on a credit card can be very, very expensive.
So the median retirement savings then among baby boomers, I think you saw the numbers on that. What are those?
So the median numbers right now were about 200,000 is what people had put away for retirement. Now, the number that people say they have to feel comfortable is considerably higher. But again, it's very much specific to you. You know, if you're somebody who's living in the suburbs or you're living in downtown Chicago, the amount of money you need to have for retirement is probably a lot higher than if you were living, you know, say 100 miles from here, living somewhere rural. It depends on what you're planning on doing for lifestyle, what you're planning on doing for trips and expenses, if you've paid your house off, if you have a pension. You know, the numbers are very personal to you at the end of the day. But in general, I'd say that Americans should be focused a bit more on it. The numbers are low.
The median retirement savings among baby boomers is less than 200,000 or less than 202,000.
Right about 200,000.
Yeah. And I don't know. Sometimes I hear numbers that are even worse than that. Maybe that's when they take into account all Americans, or they're not saying the median, but something else. But that's still not enough. When they say that number, retirement savings, do they include equity in the house, or I don't suppose they include Social Security? That's not retirement savings. That's just some future income. But I wonder what all they use to include in retirement savings.
You'd certainly have to look at the study itself, but usually they're just including retirement accounts. So they're not including equity in the house. They're not including Social Security or pensions or anything else.
So if I'm going to plan for retirement, this is what you do, right? So then what do people do first, or what do you tell them to do first?
So when you're planning for retirement, one of the first things to look at is, you know, what are your income and expenses going to look like? This is the biggest driver of how much you're going to need in retirement. I have clients of mine that we manage millions of dollars for who are going to spend the majority of it throughout their retirement. I have people on the other end who have $100,000, $200,000 who will live very comfortably the rest of their lives. And the difference comes from questions like, do you have your house paid off? Do you have a pension? Do you have two Social Securities for a couple? What are you planning on doing? If you want to travel to Europe 3 times a year, well, guess what? You're going to need to save a lot more for retirement than somebody who, you know, enjoys being around the house. So these things are all really personal to you. One of the biggest things I'd say is don't delay it. Don't bury your head in the sand. Make sure you sit down, start taking a look at numbers. If you haven't done that or you don't feel comfortable doing that, talk to a professional about it.
You know, what's intimidating to me about that is, how do I know how much money I'm going to need down the road? You know, I don't know if I'm going to have opportunities or things I thought I were going to spend on go away, or maybe there's a medical expense. I mean, it's kind of hard to calculate that number, isn't it?
It certainly is, and it's never going to be perfect. It's always going to be, you know, a rough draft of a plan going forward, because things in your life will change. But generally speaking, you know, we're also creatures of habit, and people tend to spend money in retirement similarly to what they did when they were working. It's very rare that I see somebody go from having been a frugal saver to being an extreme spender. That tends not to happen.
Right. Right. But if you did have a lot of money, or say you had a reasonable amount, say you had, what was the number? $1.46 million is the amount that most Americans mm-hmm. say they would need to feel comfortable in retirement. For some people, they're like, oh, God, that's not enough. If you could just get to those people and say, live like the other people, you know, be happy with less, you've got more than most people have. But what is it? Our spending rises to meet income or something like that?
Yeah, we call that, I'm missing the term for it, but lifestyle creep. That's what we call it. It's things that used to be a treat for you become something that you're doing every day just because you can afford it. And, you know, and that's okay as long as you keep the long-term goals, the long-term, you know, impact of that in mind.
Philip Shaw is a senior advisor at Goldstone Financial Group. Goldstone Financial Group. Hey, Philip, it's nice to talk to you today. Thanks for your insight.
You too, John.
Jim Dahlke is here, the director of communications at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. He talks to us about the tech scene. Let's start talking about biotech. What's the Chicago story today, Jim?
Hey, John. Yeah, so nice funding round from a local biotech company here in Chicago. The company is called Vanqua Bio. Just raised $45 million in new funding. This is a startup that's working on some next-generation medicines focused on neurodegenerative diseases like Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, different kind of diseases like that. This comes on the heels of the company raising about $85 million just a few years ago. They also moved into a new office in the Fulton Labs area in Fulton Market. So some nice funding here from a really interesting biotech company. And, you know, as we've seen, the funding environment has not been as attractive nationally or in Chicago as it was kind of in the COVID heydays. But hey, companies that are really working on impressive technology are still able to raise fundraising rounds.
So if a venture capitalist says, okay, here's $45 million more for this biotech startup, what do they do with that money? Do they hire people? Do they buy equipment? We always hear these stories. What does it do, would you say?
Yeah, I think it's all of what you mentioned. So it's certainly people. So these kind of businesses require lots of talent inside the building, physical lab space as well. Biotech businesses can be very expensive. So from everything from equipment to the lab space itself is very important and very expensive. And, you know, research and development. I mean, these products take time. So it's not, you know, the biotech space is not exactly like a business software. You know, it's hard to kind of spin up a minimum viable product the way you can with business software, right? So these are businesses that take a lot longer to materialize. You know, the pathway to bringing these to life is a lot different than a traditional software startup. And so they require a lot of capital. And, you know, it's an area that Chicago historically has kind of lagged behind its peers in. You know, other cities have kind of materialized as these hotbeds for biotech innovation, certainly Boston, San Diego, Philadelphia, and Chicago is really working to kind of grow its momentum there. And so a nice bit of funding round from a local biotech startup here to keep the momentum in the sector.
Well, you think with Lurie and Northwestern and U of C and Rush and all of these major medical centers all within just a few miles of each other, that Chicago would be a magnet for that kind of capital.
Yeah, and you're really seeing, you know, the companies that have decided to double down here and raise here are mentioning mentioning exactly that. So that connection to the healthcare community is, you know, really one reason that's helping these companies get off the ground. But, you know, another thing is space. You know, Chicago has historically kind of lacked in available lab space. There are different initiatives going on right now to change that, to get more lab space available to these startups. You know, not a biotech startup can't just open up shop in a WeWork, right? They need very specialized lab space and dedicated facilities.
Talk to me about Symbiosys technology.
Yeah, so this is a medical technology startup. You know, really interesting. They are working on artificial intelligence technology using a little bit of spatial computing and modeling to help surgeons better see tumors inside a patient. So really focusing on cancer tumors. What they can do is they can help surgeons create these detailed 3D models of a patient's cancer tumor using their technology and allow them to better determine the best route of care for that patient. And really, you know, kind of fascinating technology here. This year, they just received FDA clearance for their platform. So they're really off and running, and they raised a $15 million fundraising round a couple of years ago and are just about to close on another $20 to $25 million here in the coming months. And speaking of Fulton Market, this company is also opening up new headquarters in the Fulton Market area here in Chicago. So Fulton Market clearly becoming, you know, growing on its momentum as a hotspot for all types of tech startups. You know, Chicago startup Cameo just recently announced it's opening up some space in the Fulton Market area as well. And so the Fulton Market continues to be a hot space for hot startups in Chicago.
I wonder what came first, the chicken or the egg. Is that area so hot because all of these new people and dollars are coming in and therefore all the cool restaurants go there and therefore there's interesting condos going there? Or were the condos and restaurants there and that attracted all of these people?
Yeah, you know, I think Restaurant Row really kind of made that area a place people wanted to kind of live and work. And I think that, you know, certainly as rents became a little bit cheaper, maybe compared to the heart of downtown years ago, you know, these startups kind of migrated a little bit west and found some, you know, attractive office space. And so, you know, really what happens is it kind of builds on itself. And there's a benefit for, you know, these startups being located close to one another. You know, you think about Sand Hill Road in Silicon Valley, a lot of the venture firms are all based out there. There's sort of power and kind of clustering, you know, technology innovations and startups and VC firms all in sort of one area where everybody can kind of congregate and get together and share ideas. And so, yeah, Fulton Market continuing its hot streak.
So one last thing then. While Chicago saw a few successful fundraisers in the last quarter, overall funding is declining in Chicago. Is that the score?
Yeah, the latest report had Chicago last quarter raising about $575 million in venture capital deals. So, you know, that number might sound like a lot, but it's actually down from about $830 million last quarter and $850 million from the first quarter last year. And so really what we're looking at here is the continued downward trend. We saw in 2021 Chicago startups in total raised about $7 billion, and in 2022 it was $10 billion. Last year it was $2.4 billion. And so, you know, clearly one issue here is that startups are having trouble exiting. They're having trouble returning capital, you know, back to the investors that put money in these VC firms. But maybe that is going to start to change. Chicago saw two major exits last quarter. So Tempest AI went public last quarter, and Tegas, a financial software firm, was acquired for $930 million. So two very significant startup exits here in Chicago. Chicago was actually one of only a handful of cities that saw more than one startup exit. Boston, New York, San Diego, and the Bay Area, and Seattle were the only other metros in the country that saw more than one venture-backed startup exit last quarter. So a two on the board there for Chicago is going to mean, you know, more money in the hands of investors and then the investors that invested in those funds. And so that's kind of what keeps the startup community and the startup ecosystem spinning, is when these startups actually return money to the people that initially invested in them.
I don't know that I've heard the word exit used that way before, but it does speak to how precarious then venture capitalism is if one or two is a good number for a city as big as Chicago.
Yeah, and you know, that's kind of the nature of venture capital overall. You make lots of bets, and you need a good handful to do pretty well. You need another handful to do very well, and you need only just a couple to do very, very, very well, and you're going to have a successful investment cycle. Mm.
Jim Dahlke is the director of communications over at Tech Nexus Venture Collaborative. Okay, Jim, we'll check in with you next week. Thanks for your insight.
Thanks, John.
Have a good day. Let's continue on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Here's more business news with Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. A Chicago-based cannabis operator raised nearly $95 million in April, and according to a group that tracks fundraising by startups, it's the largest money round for a Chicago startup in the second quarter of this year. PharmaCann made the haul according to PitchBook. Biotech company Advanced Medicine Partners landed the second highest funding round of the quarter in Chicago with $60 million. According to Chicago Inno, other companies raising big funds were Clear Cover at $55 million and Hopscotch Primary Care at $45 million. Cranes reports a mostly vacant office building on the Magnificent Mile could become residential soon. The building's located at 500 North Michigan and would include 320 apartments. The proposal still has to be approved by city zoning officials. Commonwealth Development Partners has a contract to buy the 24-story building. The proposal could be a significant boost to an area plagued by vacancies. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
Okay, thank you for that. Now the business of food. Here's Steve Alexander.
Yeah, thank you. And here is something that not every restaurant can say.
The parking lot here was a registered heliport.
That was in the 1950s.
My grandfather's friend was one of the teachers at Lewis University.
A man named Albert Luke, a helicopter pioneer.
And they used to fly the helicopter to the restaurant.
That restaurant with its own heliport is Marishka's in Crest Hill.
We're neighbors with Joliet.
And that voice you're hearing is Ryan George, one of the managers at Marishka's and one of the many family members who have kept the place running since
1933.
Ryan's mother, Mary, is now the owner of Marishka's, which was named for her grandmother.
Marishka was my great-grandmother, and then my grandfather, Joe Zdravovich, they really started the restaurant, along with Rose Kalanth.
And what is now a destination restaurant for many people came from humble beginnings.
They would sell sandwiches to the road crew that was building the highways in the area. It was originally just my great-grandmother's house.
He says it's been added onto a lot over the years, maybe 8 times, and it continues to be a family affair.
My cousin and I are two of the managers. My sister, Rebecca, also, and my cousin, Joe, and then his sister, Kelly. We're the fourth generation, and then we have 6 nieces and nephews that are all part of the restaurant.
Marishka's claim to fame, other than being a family-run business for 91 years, is...
The poor boy sandwich.
Which got its start in the 1950s at Churchill Downs.
My great-grandmother and her friend, Rose Kalanth, they went to the Kentucky Derby in the 50s, and they had the po' boy, which is like shrimp on a sandwich, and they put their own twist to it, making it out of cube steak and putting garlic butter on the bread.
And there's a lot more on the menu that has kept customers coming back all these years. It is a big operation with its own butcher shop and 90 employees. And the keys to success?
Big part of it is family involvement and everyone working together and pulling their weight.
And how about this? They all get along.
Yes. Yeah, we're very close.
Okay, if you want to fly your helicopter to the Marishka's heliport... Sorry.
You know, it's long gone now.
So you'll have to drive. And speaking of that, we are sponsored today by the Chevy Silverado and ChevyDriveChicago.com. There's never been a better time to put a Silverado in your toolbox. I'm Steve Alexander. That's the business of food on 720 WGN.
Don Melchiori is the executive director of Cradles to Crayons in Chicago. Let's talk a little bit about that. I guess it's time. Huh, Don, welcome back.
Thanks, John. Great to be back. Yes, it's time again for our Ready for Learning initiative and making sure that we can provide Chicagoland students with everything they need to get ready for school.
So what do? You build backpacks for kids? You stuff them up?
We do. So at Cradles to Crayons, our goal is to distribute 105,000 backpacks. They're brand new backpacks, and they include everything a child should need: folders, glue sticks, pens, pencils, erasers. Everything that they will need to make sure that they start school ready to learn.
Who gets these backpacks?
So we work with, at Cradles to Crayons, about 60 different service partners throughout the Chicagoland area. And for this initiative, one of our biggest partners is Chicago Public Schools. So we have a partnership with them to make sure that they are going into the schools that they know there is the most need. And then we have a lot of other large partners that work with Chicago Public School students throughout the area.
Are these financially disadvantaged? Not every CPS student is financially disadvantaged. Many are, but is there a sort of income threshold?
Yeah, so what we really look for is for children who are experiencing homelessness or are in very low-income situations, which is why our partnership with CPS is so important, because we're really targeting the schools and the students that they know have the most need.
You said three of the top 10 reasons that children do not attend school are rooted in clothing insecurity and lack of school supplies. Really?
Yes. I know it's hard to believe, but we hear it so often from teachers and school administrators and even parents that the lack of having adequate clothing, for one thing, is something that a lot of these families are facing. So you'll find kids who will take turns with the one winter coat that a family might have, or who feel embarrassed because they have just one outfit that they wear every single day.
I would imagine that the most important thing in a kid's backpack these days is a laptop. You're not giving kids laptops. Does CPS provide the kids with all the computer technology they need?
Yeah, I would say we don't have the resources to do that, but that is something that they that is then school specific, and a lot of our school supplies are really going for the younger kids, so the kids in fourth grade and younger.
So walk me through one of those backpacks then. So if it's a fourth grader, third grader, fill that thing up for me. What's in there?
Yep. So it's a brand new great size backpack. They're going to have two folders, they're going to have two notebooks, they're going to have pencils, both colored pencils and regular pencils. There's glue sticks, there's scissors and safety scissors, erasers and pencil sharpeners. And then we also have a well-wish note. So all of the volunteers that help us create these backpacks, we create custom well-wish notes so that kids know that their backpack was made by somebody who cares about them, and that there's people out there that are rooting for their success.
A well-wish note. Probably the backpack itself is an important thing, too, right? It seems like all the kids have a backpack these days, like they're going into the mountains. But I presume a good one that'll sort of hold up for a year is not a small consideration.
Correct, because we know that they're going to be bringing books home and other things that they need to carry back and forth with school with them. So having something that that can last them the whole year. So we really focus on the quality of the items that we're giving out, because we know the quality equals dignity, and makes them feel good and proud to have that backpack.
In 2023, you all report parents spent more than $890 on school supplies, including clothing, shoes. Expenses are expected to rise this year. This will cut into that burden for a lot of these families. Where do you get the money? How do folks donate to you?
Yeah, so if folks are interested in donating and creating kind of their own school supply activities for their family, their community, our best is our website. So it's cradlestocrayons.org/Chicago. It's right on our homepage. You can see everything about Ready for Learning. We're also very fortunate. We have a very giving corporate community. And so a main driver for the funds to be able to do this comes from outstanding corporate citizens like our presenting sponsor, which is Discover.
So you don't want me to give you pencils. You want me to give you cash, and then you'll go buy them at a discount. Probably I can't get, I'm assuming.
Exactly, yes. We buy in a lot of bulk. 105,000 backpacks is it's a lot. So we are able to have a much greater buying power than just somebody if you would run to any kind of store and purchase them.
Dawn is the executive director of Cradles to Crayons Chicago, cradlestocrayons.org, T-O in the middle, cradlestocrayons.org, and then /Chicago. You want that in there too?
Yes.
Okay. Good on you all, Dawn. And if we can help, let's all make a donation, cradlestocrayons.org. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you so much.